Okay, so let's continue with this subject of moments. As we saw before, these image moments are not invariant to translation, rotation, or change of scale. So we have to do something about that. And the solution is called central moments, which I already mentioned with respect to probability distributions in general. So central moments are simply computed with respect to the centroid. Instead of computing the sum of I to the p power times times j to the q, you subtract the centroid, which is something that I've just computed. So what are the properties of central moments? For example, the central moment of order 0 is equal to the normal moment of order 0. Why? Because it's simply the area, so the central moment is going to be the same. And let's start asking again. What would be the central moment of order 1, 0? The sum of i bar. I'm not sure how you say that, but I say I bar. So this would be, okay? And what is that going to be? It's going to be the sum of I minus I bar, the sum of 1, right? And what is this? This is I bar, sum of 1, minus I bar, sum of 1. They are both equal to 0. Does that make sense? As I said, the moments centered around the mean of a probability distribution are equal to 0. It also makes sense that if I compute the central moments, what I'm doing is, instead of using this reference system for the blob, I'm using the centroid as the reference system for the blob. So it makes sense that the central moments of order 1 are both equal to 0. So the expected coordinate value for pixels should be equal to 0. So in this case, this moment is still useful. These two moments are always equal to 0 in every case, so they're not very useful. And what about the moment order 2, 0? Yeah, squared. Okay, so there's another eraser here. Right here. So this would be, that's what we said, I minus I bar squared. And this would be the sum of I squared minus twice I bar the sum of I, plus I squared the sum of 1. Okay, and what would this be? The sum of I squared. This is the normal moment, 2, 0. Okay, and what about this? So this is the sum of I divided the sum of 1 is I bar. Okay, so this is actually I bar times the sum of 1. So this is minus 2 I bar squared the sum of 1 plus I bar squared the sum of 1 again. Okay, so this is 2, 0 minus twice this plus once this minus once I squared, and what is the sum of 1? M0, 0. Okay, so this is just an example of the fact that if I compute the normal moment during connectivity analysis, then I can compute the centroid, and from the centroid, I can compute, and the normal moments, I can compute the central moments. Okay, so this is lousy for the transparency. Okay, so this one is correct. This is M20 minus M00 times I bar squared. All of these moments, all of these central moments, can be computed from the normal moments and the centroid. Okay, so I will only have to compute the image moments during connectivity, then the centroid, and then I can compute the central moments. You can demonstrate, actually, that these central moments are invariant to translation. The reason is, of course, that I'm... let me put this up. The reason is, of course, that I'm computing the central moments with respect to the centroid. As I said, this basically means that I will use as reference system for the moments the centroid of the blob. If I move the blob in the image, the centroid is going to change, but I'm always computing those moments with respect to the centroid. And you can demonstrate that that makes them invariant to translation. Of course, because the centroid moves with the blob. And I always then change the reference in which I compute these moments. That's also why these moments are also always equal to zero, no matter where the blob is in the image. Okay? So in this way, we are able to compute moments that are invariant to translation, which is one step. This is not something that you might want always, but if you want to make the moments invariant to scale, then you can normalize them. And the normalized moments are simply this nu of PQ is simply the central moment of order PQ divided by a power of the area. And this power is, this is a bit difficult to demonstrate, so we'll just leave it at that. You have to compute this power of the moment of order 0, 0, which is the semi-sum of p plus q all plus 1. For example, if you compute the normalized moment of order 0, 0, that's simply the central moment of order 0, 0 divided by m to the 1 power, which is equal to 1. That's, of course, what we want. We want to make them invariable to scale. So the normalized moment of any blob is always equal to 1 because it's normalized to the scale. If you make it larger or if you make it smaller, you always divide by the area, and then it's always going to be equal to 1. And that happens to all of the moments. If you normalize them in this way, you can also demonstrate that that makes them invariant to scale. That's not necessarily something that you always want. Maybe you want to distinguish smaller and larger objects that have the same shape. So in that case, you simply don't use normalized moments, but just the central moments. Okay, so these moments would be invariant to translation, and with this possibility, they would be invariant to scale. What we still lack is a way to make them invariant to orientation. And this is also a bit complicated to demonstrate. So, only in the case of the first one, it's easy to see. The only invariant moment to rotation is the area, of course. So this moment, central moment 0, 0, is invariant to rotation, but the others are not. However, there is this combination of moments that are, in fact, invariable to orientation, to rotation. So believe me that these formulas allow you to compute moments invariant to rotation. There's these 7, which depend on the first moments up to order 3. And there's an additional one which allows you to distinguish objects from its mirror image, if that's what you want. Because these objects are invariant to translation and also to the mirror image in this sense. If you want to distinguish objects from their mirror image, then you would have to include information, the information about this 8th invariant moment. So the summary is, after we compute connectivity analysis, or during connectivity analysis, we can compute the normal image moments, then we compute the centroid, then we can compute the central moments, and then we are able, we can compute, I think that for the practicals you only have to compute until this one. Okay? The first three invariant moments, two, translation and rotation. And we are hoping that this information is different, the values are different for each of the objects that we want to recognize or distinguish. So we will store this information for each of the objects that we know, and then we use it to compare with the objects that we want to recognize. This is also a practical issue, two practical issues. If you want them invariant to scale, which as I said is not always what you want, then instead of using mu, you use nu, which is the scale invariant moments. In all of these formulations, you use one instead of the other, if that's what you want. And the other, the other comment is that these values tend to be very large. So when you, so the computer is not going to care. But when you have to look at these values to see whether they are similar or not to something that you have in the database, having large values makes it very difficult to analyze this fact. So we usually use the logarithm instead of the pure invariant moments. This is just so that the values are smaller and it's more easy to compare them. But the recognition is going to be exactly the same with the original invariant moments or with the logarithm. It's just that for practical purposes of manually verifying that everything is working okay, we use this version. Okay, so that's this is the most important descriptor that we have for planar objects, but it's of course not the only one. Additionally, there's another one, which is the perimeter. The perimeter is a slightly more complicated to compute, well, to define and then to compute. So let's start by saying that the perimeter is some computation related to the pixels that are in the frontier of the blob. So if we have a binary image, the first thing that we would have to do if we want to compute perimeter is compute the frontier. Decide which pixels are actually in the frontier of the blob for which we want to compute the perimeter. And there's several algorithms for doing that. This is a more or less reasonably simple one that we use. It follows these rules. The first thing that you have to do to obtain the perimeter is find the top leftmost pixel in the blob. So for example, in the example in the next page, the topmost leftmost would be this one. You can find that easily because you have all the list of segments. So you start here, okay? And the algorithm works in this way. Let's follow the four connectivity case, which is a bit simple. So you have, what you're trying to do is always traverse the frontier, trying to always locate the next pixel, which is also part of the frontier of the blob. And for that purpose, we use a direction that tells you which way to look next to see if there's a frontier pixel or not. So in for connectivity, these are the four possible directions. And we start with direction 3, which is looking downwards, okay? So this is what the algorithm does. It starts with this pixel that we found. The initial direction is going to be this way. And then this is how we compute where to look for the next pixel in the frontier. So the next direction is going to be dir plus 3 modulus 4. Okay? If that pixel is also an object pixel, that's the next one in the frontier. And if not, we have to look counterclockwise. Counterclockwise is this way, yes. In each of the four directions, okay? So let's see if we can do this correctly. We start here. The direction is 3, okay? Which is the next pixel that, which is the next direction that we have to look for? It's dir plus 3 modulus 4. Dir plus 3 would be 6, modulus 4 is 2. So the next direction that we have to look for is 2. If this is P0, is the pixel in direction 2 part of the frontier? this is the first pixel, and this would be the pixel in direction 2. No, so we have to look counterclockwise. Okay, which would be the next direction counterclockwise? 3. Is the pixel downward part of the frontier? Yes, okay, so we label this one, direction is again 3, and we move again. So which would be the next direction that we would have to check? We are here, and direction is 3. Pablo, ¿qué más? So it would be 3 plus 3, 6, modulus 4 is 2. The direction is 2. Is the pixel in direction 2 from here part of the frontier?
Yes.
Yes, so we include it, and direction is now 2. Plus 3 modulus 4? Yeah? Okay, so we are here, and direction is 1. Is this pixel part of the frontier? So we look counterclockwise, and the next one would be this one. Okay? Do you understand how this works? Because I'm just considering all these four directions, that's all.
Yeah, but I mean, it really doesn't matter which direction
you start. It does matter, because depending on which direction you start, you would go the other way around. You can also do that if you want, but in this way you will always start in this direction. That's why the initial direction is downwards. If you start in any other direction, you could go the other way around, which would not be... you would have to change the algorithm for the sign, but you could traverse the frontier in this direction also if you wanted. So if you want to do it that way, it's not going to be counterclockwise, but clockwise. Okay, so that the algorithm works correctly. This is just a convention so that you do it in this way. Okay. If you use 8 connectivity, if you want to compute the 8 connected frontier, then you have to use these directions. And then the rule for looking at the next direction is slightly more complicated. It says this, if you compute direction modulus plus 7 modulus 8 if it's even, or direction plus 6 modulus 8 if it's odd. And this is the result that you're going to get. So there's these two pixels are different, and some pixels around here. Okay. In this case, you compute the 4 connected frontier, and in this case, you compute the 8 connected frontier. So it really depends on what you want to do. But in every case, this is going to work as long as I think there's at least 2 pixels. Let's see. There's some rules saying that this works if at least there's 2 pixels in the blob. So anything larger, which is what we're interested in, will do. This is just one part of our problem of computing the perimeter. This is only the frontier. So now, how do we compute the perimeter? This is not an easy matter, because we could use several definitions. So we could say, let's just count the number of pixels in the frontier. That would be one possibility. We could also say, let's count the number of sites, or the length of the sites which are adjacent to the background, which would be another possibility. And both of them you could conceive of using them. There's an important effect of digitization in the issue of perimeter, and in this simple example you can see that if I compute the 8 connected frontier, there's 12 pixels, the 4 connected frontier is also 12 pixels, and the number of sites adjacent to the background is 16. If I rotate this object in this way, the digitization could be something like this, and now you would only have eight connected pixels, or again 12 4 connected pixels, and the number of sites would be 20. So there can be an important distortion because of digitization when you rotate the object. And for that reason, we usually try to mitigate that problem using what we call cutting corners. And cutting corners is simply, let's say, compensating for digitization by eliminating from the length the use of both convex and concave corners. So it works in this simple way. Basically, I'm going to compute the length of the sides, okay? And if I'm using the calibration of the camera, then I know that this is going to be the size in X and this is going to be the size in Y, or otherwise it will be just one if I'm not using the calibration. I'm going to compute the total length of the perimeter, but I want to cut the corners, so I want to, in this case, compute up to here, then compute this, and then also compute this. So I want not to have this into account and not to have that into account. Okay, so this would be x half, this s, oops, sy half, and this would be the square root of sx squared 2 squared plus xy squared 2 squared. Okay, that's the reason for this rule that I'm going to use. The algorithm for computing the perimeter will actually do this. You will count, which can also be done during connectivity. You will count the number of horizontal frontiers in the blob. You will count the number of vertical frontiers, pixels that have a vertical frontier with a background, which can also be done during connectivity. And you will also count how many corners you have. Okay? And then the final computation for your perimeter is going to be this one. You say, well, this is going to be the number of horizontal frontiers times the sides in X plus the number of vertical frontiers times XY. And then since we added this part and this part, we're going to subtract it here and then instead add this term, which is this term here. And that depends on the number of corners. Okay, so in this image, the total length that we would compute is the one drawn without the corners that we blame for the problem of digitalization. This solution, I think it's 5% more precise than using only the number of horizontal frontiers and the number of vertical frontiers. So it's a real improvement in terms of computing the perimeter. And this is the way in which this is usually done. So I think there's the practical, that the lab number 5 proposes to compute the perimeter and you have to use this formula. Is this clear? More or less? Okay. Last thing, well, almost last thing, is how to compute orientation. Orientation is also a descriptor that is used for locating the object, of course. And there's also many definitions that we could use for orientation. This is the one that we think is best. We will compute the axis of minimum inertia of the object. And this, of course, comes from mechanics, you know. In the case of binary digital images, the axis of minimum inertia is equal to the minimum to the orientation in which the order of the moment of order 2 is minimum. Okay, so before just seeing what the details for computing this orientation are, let's think about what the axis of minimum inertia actually is. Which shapes have an infinite number of axes of minimal inertia? I'm sorry? Symmetric objects can have only one. I mean an infinite number. A circle. Okay, so the orientation is not defined for circles, which actually makes sense. In this case, it would mean that If I compute orientation, any orientation is going to be an axis of minimal inertia. Okay, so circles don't have any orientation, or we can't compute orientation for circles, which of course makes sense. And shapes that have more than one axis of minimal inertia, los que lecos, no es que los informáticos lo sepan mejor. It's figures that have more than one axis of symmetry. In 2D, no, you would have infinite. Several, but not infinite. A figure that has more than one axis of symmetry.
Square.
A square. So a square is also going to be problematic, because it might have this one or this one. Okay? And so we're not going to be able to compute one in these cases, but in many other cases we will be able to compute one of the axes, and we're going to use that axis as the orientation of the object that we have in the image. So in order to compute this axis of minimal inertia, we're going to do this reasonably simple math. We're going to define that axis as with using polar coordinates, with rho and theta parameters. And you know that the equation for a line in polar coordinates is this one, which this is rho is equal to x cosine theta plus y sine of theta. So what we're going to compute is the minimal order, moment of order 2. So for that purpose, we have to compute the square distance from of all of the pixels to the line that we are trying to compute. And the distance of any pixel is going to be precisely this. If the pixel belongs to the line, then the equation holds and r would be 0. And if the pixel does not belong to the line, then its square distance is going to be this one. So what do we want to do? We want to minimize the sum of all of the square distances of all of the pixels to this axis. And so this would be the equation. How do we compute the minimum? We differentiate and then equal to 0. And if we differentiate this equation, this is the result of that we're going to get. The axis of minimal inertia will obey, the parameters will obey this equation. And notice that this is the moment of order 0, 1, the moment of order 1, 0, and the moment of order 0, 0, if we're using the coordinates of the pixels. So if you make this equal to 1, you will find, and that is something that makes sense, that the centroid always belongs to the axis of minimal inertia. So centroid obeys, the centroid I bar, J bar, obeys this equation, or thing the term is satisfies this equation, which means the centroid is one pixel of the axis of minimal inertia. So we already know one thing, and the following thing that we then have to find is the value for theta. And this is very simple. We just substitute in the original equation rho for its corresponding value for the centroid. And then we have to find what the value of theta will be that will satisfy that equation. And the solution is this one. So in summary, if you want to want to know the orientation of the axis of minimal inertia, you have to compute the arctangent of this combination of central moments and divide by 2. The arctangent of this combination and then divide by 2. So with respect to the solution, there's a couple of important things to see. In the case of circles, this will be equal to this one. The moment of order 2, 0 will be equal to moment 0, 2. And moment 1, 1 will be 0. So it will be the arctangent of 0 divided by 0. That's why we will not be able to compute the orientation for circles. In case this is equal to 0, but this is not, then it's going to be this orientation. Okay? And the other way around is simply going to be like this. And so that's one thing that more or less makes sense. The other important thing is to realize that the arctangent function has values for minus pi to pi. But I'm dividing by 2 here. What does that mean? That simply means that if the object has this orientation, I will get as a result this angle, because the value for theta is always going to be between minus pi half and pi half. So it's only going to be within this range. Okay, so if the axis is this one, then I will get this positive angle. And if the axis is this one, then I will get this negative angle, always. Okay? So it's not exactly, a direction, but it's a full axis. So you have the ambiguity of whether the direction is this one or this one. Okay? That is some ambiguity which is inherent to the use of the axis of minimal inertia. And finally, with respect to the implementation, it's important that you bear in mind to use the ATAN2 function, because that will allow you to differentiate between this value and this value using the sign of the numerator and the denominator. So don't use ATAN, use ATAN2. This is just a simple issue with respect to implementation. As you can see, orientation is also computed from the central moments. So you compute the image moments, the centroid, the central moments, the invariant moments, and then you can also compute the orientation. And the orientation is simply drawn in the image as an axis in this way. Okay? If both of these values are zero or close to zero, then you have to say, I can't compute the orientation for this object. I think that's basically all, with respect to orientation. Only a couple of other descriptors that are useful for recognition. Sometimes we use a combination of information about the perimeter and information about the area. And this usually is called elongation or compactness, which is a related concept. So the elongation is defined as the square of the perimeter divided by the area. Okay? And compactness is 4 pi divided by the elongation. So as I said, it's completely related concepts. One or the other can be used in the same way. What does compactness or elongation tell you about the object? Well, it's useful to compute it for the circle to find out exactly what that means. So the elongation for the circle would be the perimeter of the circle squared, or the circumference, divided by the area. What would be the perimeter squared of a circle? So what's the perimeter of a circle? 2πr. And the area? The area of a circle? P? Πr squared. And the perimeter is 2π squared. So perimeter squared divided by the area is 2 times pi times r squared divided by pi r squared, 4 pi. The other way around. The circle is the less elongated of all planar objects. That's why this rule holds. The elongation of any other planar object is going to be greater than 4 pi. Okay, so this is the smallest value for elongation, and that's why actually we instead use compactness. Compactness is the opposite. You divide by 4 pi divided by the elongation, which means that in the case of the circle, it's going to be 1. Okay, so the circle is the most compact of all objects, and any other object will have a compactness less than or equal to 1. Okay? You can check that, for example, in the case of squares, if you have a square of size L, then the elongation is going to be the perimeter squared, which would be 4L squared divided by the area, which is L squared. The elongation for a square is always 16. No matter what the length of the side is. And if you have a rectangle like this, which is, I just set it up so that the perimeter is the same. The perimeter would be the same, but the area is slightly smaller. And thus, the resulting elongation is 64 divided by 3, which is less than 22. Okay? So this rectangle is more elongated than a square of the same perimeter. In the limit, if you make a figure that has the same perimeter but less area, you would make you would reach an area of zero. So the elongation is always growing if you make the object more flat, if you want, for the same perimeter. So as this makes sense with the name, more elongated objects with the same perimeter are going to have a higher value for elongation and a smaller value for compactness. And you can also use this as a measure of to identify or distinguish between objects. Of course, it depends on perimeter and area. So it doesn't make sense to use the three, because the third one depends on the first two. Okay? This is this issue of, let's say, correlation will be discussed in the next lesson. I think there's a final one, which is the Euler number. The Euler number is actually a topological descriptor, not instead of metric. It measures how many components a figure has minus the number of holes. So, for example, this interrogation figure has two components and no holes. So the Euler number would be 2. The Euler number of 3 would be 1 component minus 0 hole 1. This would be 1 minus 2, and this would be 1 minus 1. Okay? As I said, it's more than metric, it's topological, because you compute not actually the value for the holes, but how many there are. And this means that it should be measured without noise. It doesn't matter what the area of the holes are. It's just the number. That doesn't mean that it's not sensitive to noise, because it actually is highly sensitive to noise. So this is one of the real images that we are processing. And you see, because of problems of thresholding, actually this figure has 1, 2, 3, 4 holes. So number one usually should have Euler number 1, but this figure would have Euler number minus 3. So the error actually, so the value actually is very sensitive to noise in thresholding. And for this reason, the Euler number is not normally used in that way. We use this alternative definition, which is compute the total area of holes. So this would be a total area of only 4 pixels, which would be close to 0. And the total area of the of number 1 would be defined as 0. So this would be a value with a small noise with respect to with respect to the theoretical value. Luckily, that was my last transparency. Any question? Okay, see you next week then.
En este caso del ruido este en el 1, ¿no se podría hacer también un análisis de conectividad del fondo para eliminar esos
se puede problemas? Sí, pero como no os he contado cómo mejorar la umbralización haciendo eso, de momento lo digo así. En la lección 5 te explico cómo eliminar esos ruidos de sal y pimienta para que eso no sea un problema tan grave. Entonces te lo contaré en la lección 5.
Vale.
Venga.